KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. These days when you hear the words tea party, you don't think about Boston Harbor anymore or a beautiful little tea party with scones. What is the Tea Party, and how does it link back to other right-wing movements throughout American history? We're going to talk with University of Washington political scientist Chris Parker later this hour. And after 10 o'clock, Seattle chefs Rachel Yang and Kenyatta Carter get us ready to heat up our holiday grills. After months of deadlock, as you heard, state lawmakers finally passed a budget that Governor Inslee signed, and with that, they packed up and headed home. We've been taking time every Monday to talk with Everett Herald political writer Jerry Kornfield, and Jerry joins us one last time to take stock of what the legislature accomplished this year and what it left undone. Hello, Jerry.
Good morning.
You must be feeling relieved that you don't have to spend another 3 weeks covering the legislature.
Well, what am I going to do?
I don't know. Talk to us. Well, so
I feel like Senator Jim Hargrove, when he saw the budget come up, and the first thing he said, yelled out was, yippee, a budget.
Well, what? Give us some of the highlights of this budget agreement.
Oh, who knows? No, it's 483 pages, and you know, if you started in January and you look now, you wonder why it took so long. There is many of the components that were agreed to and approved in the House and Senate on their own back in April are still there. There's an expansion of Medicaid, which means an estimated 300,000 people with low incomes that have not been eligible for the Medicaid, they're going to be become eligible in the near future, and the federal government is going to pick up the full tab, at least for the next 2 years. That's a federal health care law, a reform that the state's taking advantage of. There's $1 billion for basic education of elementary and secondary school students and what everyone's calling a down payment towards full state funding of basic education as required by a 2012 Supreme Court decision. And all four caucuses had ideas about $1 billion back in April, so they got there. Higher education is going to get more money for the first time in a couple of years. And I want to put an asterisk next to this next point that they, you know, they're very proud that they didn't raise tuition, but they kind of made it impossible for the colleges to raise tuition. They took so long, there's no way any of the universities or community colleges could turn around and tell students in July that, oh, by the way, we're going to tack on another 2-3% tuition rate. So it wasn't going to rise anyway. They took so long.
While we're on education, before we talk about some other dollars and cents figures, I know that there were some education policy changes for K-12 education being pushed by Republicans. Whatever happened to those?
Well, you know, I think what happened is they did receive, they had a discussion, and some of them are moving forward and some are not. And their most hardcore positions are not moving forward, and by that I mean they started with a bill in the early part of the year that third-grade students who didn't pass a reading test would be flunked. And it was just sort of a, you don't pass, you don't go forward. And in the end, they ended up with putting some money out of that $1 billion into more intensive mentoring and instruction for third and fourth graders. And now the bill that's on the books looks like it's around fifth grade. At that point, they have got to start performing or they're going to be doing summer school, and there's a chance they'll be kept back if they don't make it. But it's been watered down and an increase in instructional aid. There was a bill that totally died, but they're going to try again in 2014, called mutual consent. Not sure why they call it that, but it's the principals on their own can decide teachers want to be or not want to be who they want at their schools. And that's a bill they really thought was important to let principals control the teaching staff. The governor, the teachers, Democrats all pushed back, and in the end that bill was set aside. But there's a push towards tougher testing and more weight given to the test scores and evaluating the performance of teachers, and an overall message of let's try to put more effort into helping those students who aren't performing well do better and in the lower grades. And so that's kind of where their reforms are ending up.
And one last thing on education, the teachers are not getting cost of living raises?
Yeah, that's become, 4 years now, 2 budgets in a row, they've suspended them. And, you know, it's getting to the point where I think the legislature is going to have to seriously think whether they want to keep the Initiative 732 language on the books, because all four caucuses started the year in their minds planning to suspend that. So I think they've just decided they can't afford to have cost of living increases for teachers as an automatic, even though the voters put it there. So I imagine that 2014 we may see that debate come up to permanently delete that language from the books.
Did state workers get a cost of living raise, or at least the opportunity to get one?
They did, and what the contract does is there's no more furloughs. There was furloughs in which they didn't work for several days, and as a result didn't get paid for those, and it worked out to essentially a pay cut. And that happened in the last budget that ended Sunday. This budget cycle, furloughs are wiped out, and the collective bargaining agreement that has a small increase, not as much as the cost of living, but they do have an increase over the next in each of the next 2 years. So those were funded. And also the home health care workers, they had gone to court over their salaries, and they won. It's not a large raise for the people who are making $10 an hour. They'll make, less than another 50 or 75 cents an hour, but it's an important victory for home health care workers to get a raise.
Let's talk about the deadly T word, taxes. We heard sort of the top of the line is no 10-cent per gallon gas tax hike for transportation. But there was a big push by Democrats to close tax loopholes. And it seemed like at the end of the session, there were some small, maybe not tax exemptions, but sort of tax waiver programs that did go through.
Yeah, I mean, if I had to have projected in January what was going to happen at the end, which in June, I would have probably projected exactly what they did. They started the year with 2 Supreme Court cases telling them they needed to work on the telecommunications industry and the estate taxes. Certain policies of the state were tossed out by the court, and the lawmakers on both sides of the aisle said, okay, we need to make a legislative fix so that we can close a loophole in the estate tax and deal with this telecommunications issue. And the bottom line was that's $250 million, and I think they were always going to do it. It just took them a while. As far as the tax breaks, tax waivers that went in at the end, I think it added up to around $16 million total. Again, some of those were offered early, whether they were an extension of a tax break for beekeepers, or there was another one that was being pushed by the House Speaker and the Governor, as well as Republicans, for making repairs and upgrading and fixing private airplanes, but the large airplanes. Not many of them get flown in here and fixed, but folks think that would help bring some of the rich folks who own big planes, bring them to this state to get fixed. That's $1.5 million a year. So that one was added in. So there were a handful. I don't think they were ever going to be that controversial. The Democrats did not get any of the major tax breaks, tax loophole closures they were seeking in January, and that's got to be really disappointing for them. Not sure they'll ever get any of those at this point.
The big granddaddy, I mentioned the gas tax hike did not go through. Governor Inslee did not get his transportation budget passed.
Again, these things sometimes feel predictable. Governor Gregoire last year didn't get the same kind of program was being discussed over the last couple of years. Transportation has become so difficult for the state legislature because for one reason or another, whether it's the size of the gas tax or this year, I think it imploded as much about the size of the gas tax as the content of the project list. You have the new bridge on I-5 over the Columbia River was in there. And it's been very controversial, and a group of senators just locked up. In fact, the whole coalition locked up. And as long as that project was in the mix, they weren't going to move that transportation plan. And that becomes a problem because they really needed to, they didn't have any way around it. Governor Inslee was, he was locked in. He was going to push that, and he wasn't going to take it out of the package.
Well, another perhaps less visible statewide part of that budget were extensions of taxing authorities for, I believe, Pierce, King, and possibly Snohomish County as well. King County wanted to get taxing authority to keep bus service in place. So if the transit if the transportation budget didn't pass, those didn't pass either, right?
Right. They have been tried individually, and they've been tried collectively. By that, I mean they've run bills by themselves to try to get the authority, and they've also put that bill as part of a transportation package. Sometimes they put it in there hoping they can slide it past those lawmakers outside of King County who don't like it. And they just haven't been able to do that. And I'm not sure if that's a case of everybody sort of feeling like they're protecting the taxpayers of King County, or if they feel like if you open the door for the largest county in the state to allow governments to raise money for roads and so forth in that manner, it could happen in all 39 counties. So they don't want it to happen in one place because it could happen everywhere. But you know, it's Snohomish County and Pierce County both have similar issues. We're trying similar tactics, and I think it's now the third year in a row these efforts have failed.
Well, so looking back at these 153 days, am I right about that?
It feels like an eternity, but 153, that's fine. Yeah.
Who was the big winner, or who were the big winners?
Well, you know, it's difficult. I think the Senate Majority Coalition Caucus has to feel proud of itself. It did, you know, prevent major tax increases from happening, and they said that was their thing that they wanted to do. I think other big winners, big beer. They had a 50-cent a gallon tax that the Democrats wanted to extend. It's gone, and today I doubt the beer prices have dropped, but it's not being collected anymore. Once again, Oregon residents won. There was once again a discussion to make them pay sales tax when they come across the border. That wasn't wiped out. It's those kinds of power groups and other groups who are probably the big winners this year. I'd like to say that the elementary and secondary students are big winners. They're getting the money until it's actually invested in the schools. We may not see the payoff for several years, so it may be premature to say they're big winners by just getting more money into the schools.
And finally, Jerry, an assessment of the first legislative session for Governor Jay Inslee. How'd he do?
Oh, boy. Putting me on the spot, because it's tough to, you know, he had come from another world, and I think he learned something almost every day of the session about how to deal with the state and not the federal government. I mean, if you play partisan politics, as he did at times, the Republicans just played it right back, and I think we saw that on the transportation. They dug in. He's got a lot to learn about the personalities of the individual lawmakers as well as the dynamics of the legislature. I'm not sure he can walk away from this with a lot of big victories that he can claim are his. And it's not too long till 2014, so I suspect we'll see a little different approach later this year and definitely in the 2014 session.
Well, what happens now? Everybody fled Olympia, right? So all's quiet in town there?
Well, yeah, they fled, and even though it's not a government shutdown, there aren't a lot of cars here. But it is a holiday week. But they'll be back. November or December, I forget which, they have committee days, and they'll be starting to talk about some items. And if this Senate Majority Coalition stays together, and depending on the outcome of the November elections, 2014 could be even a more interesting year, because I think the caucus in the Senate has figured out a little more of its own dynamics. And if they're talking about wanting to do transportation, so they'll put something on the table, and that might be a winning formula. And so there may be some real improvements next year in that area.
Or else maybe they'll move on to three extra legislative sessions.
And they could get there with only a 60-day scheduled session. Just think, to get to 150 days, do the math. Yeah, we'll be there. But we don't want to wish that upon anyone, and there is an election year next year. All of them are on, not all of them, but many of the legislature are on the ballot next year. So there may be a little more motivation to be done on time.
Well, Jerry, it's been a pleasure speaking with you every week. We won't know what to do without you, but enjoy some rest. I hope you get some.
Well, thank you very much, and we'll hope the governor doesn't call him back for a special session between now and January.
And if they do, we hope to talk to you then. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Jerry Cornfield writes about state politics for the Everett Herald. He's been a regular Monday guest since January, when the regular legislative session began. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
921. Our next guest had quite a career in showbiz. He worked with Woody Allen. He wrote for The Odd Couple. He hosted a game show, which he now says was relatively dreadful. What game show was it, and why was it dreadful? Stick around and find out. A conversation with Frank Buxton in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Delta Dental, with a wide provider network that includes nearly 90% of Washington State dentists. More information and a list of participating dentists are available at deltadentalwa.com.
If you liked yesterday's weather, you're going to like today. Mostly sunny with highs in the low 90s, and it's going to be sunny and hot all week. 922, I'm Bernard Ouellette. Later this hour, a tea party. Well, the Tea Party, the conservative political movement that's gotten so much attention these past few years. What motivates the Tea Party, and what is it about the Tea Party's message that attracts people? We'll steep ourselves in that 10 minutes from now.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. Frank Buxton has had a long and varied career in the entertainment industry. He's been a director, producer, actor, stand-up comedian, game show host, commercial spokesman, author, scriptwriter on radio, film, and on television. And he joins me in the studio. Thanks for coming in.
Not at all. Thank you for asking me.
I would like to talk about television with you. You hosted a show called Discovery in the 1960s.
I did.
For most of the 1960s. What was that show?
Discovery was initially it was a half-hour show Monday through Friday on ABC in the afternoon, a program for young people, not for children, not for teenagers, but for young people.
Discovery 66, the award-winning program for young people with Frank Buxton and Virginia Gibson.
Discovery covered subject after subject after subject. One day we would be doing Africa. The next day we would do the origin of money. We traveled all over the world. It was a great job. Fed a baby giraffe in Africa from a bottle. Visited a rice merchant in Tokyo. In subsequent years, a lot of it had to do with going around the world and showing young people what life was like for an Aleut in Alaska, for instance, or what it was like to grow up in Tokyo. One of the highlights of Discovery was that what was the year of John Kennedy's assassination? A few months after that, we went to Moscow, highly unheard of in those days because it was the height of the Cold War. We were able to show what it was like for young people living in Moscow. Now, this is the days of communism and the young pioneers and so forth and so forth. We made no value judgment on any of this. We just showed what they ate, how they lived, where they went to school, so forth and so forth. My gosh, what an experience to be there at that time. And we would walk down the street and people would know by our clothes or whatever that we were not Russian. And they would come up and they would, with tears in their eyes, they would say, Kennedy, 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 because it was about a month or so after he was assassinated. Despite the people up on top, premiers and the presidents and so forth, the people were the people, and they wanted to know us and love us and like us. And they didn't just profess peace, they wanted peace.
What sort of reaction did you get from kids who watched the show?
Well, it depends upon their orientation. If they were being brought up by people who were red baiters or whatever, then we got a lot of protests. Others, you know, the other side of the coin was people who praised us for our bravery, if you can call it that, our courage to do this. Tell you one other story about being in Moscow. We were having dinner in the hotel one night, and I looked over to another table, and there was Norman Rockwell. And we introduced ourselves and so forth, because there weren't that many Americans in Moscow, especially in this hotel. And we said, what are you doing here? And he said, well, I'm on an assignment from Look magazine to paint children of Russia, of Moscow, you know, faces, so forth. And he says, but I'm having a terrible time getting permission to go into a school. And we said, we are filming in a school tomorrow. Would you like to be part of our crew? And Norman said, oh, I think I would. So literally Norman carried a light box into the school and sat in the back of the room while we were filming, sketching.
Did you have any trouble getting permission as a TV show?
I wasn't privy to that because I was the host. But I can tell you that, yes, Our State Department was not happy with it. The people there wondered what we were doing. What are you filming? What is this? You know, so forth and so forth. And when we left the Soviet Union, we had to pass through customs, and they looked in our luggage and saw these scripts. I thought we were never going to get out of the place. And Danny Wilson, who was our producer on that show, pulled out reams of red tape permissions and so forth and showed it to them and just overwhelmed them with all of the stuff that we had that permitted us to do what we were doing. So we got out. I'm not there.
You're not there. You're
no,
here.
No, I'm here.
In Seattle.
Yes.
I'm speaking with Frank Buxton, who had a long entertainment career on TV and film. I'm interested in your stint as a game show host on a show called Get the Message.
And now, here is your host, Frank Buxton.
Hi. Hi, thank you. Good morning. Good morning to you all. Welcome to Get the Message, the game of clues where the men play against the women.
What was the game? How did you play Get the Message?
The game was a Goodson Todman production, and it was an amalgam of a lot of things that they already had done. A little bit from I've Got a Secret, a little bit from Beat the Clock, a little bit from a relatively dreadful program, if I remember correctly. And it consisted of me and two celebrity guests and two what we called civilians right there trying to get the message. They would get little hints and clues and stuff like that. So it was more like Password than anything else, I guess. It lasted for three cycles. At the same time, I was doing Discovery, so I was working like crazy in those days.
What is it actually like to be a game show host? Give us the insider look.
Yeah, what is it like to be? Well, you got to be, this is a little self-serving, but you got to be personable. You got to be fast on your feet. You don't want to be snotty. That got me in trouble in rehearsals, was being snotty, because I was good at that. but never when the tape was rolling.
What about Hot Dog? What's that?
Ooh, Hot Dog. Hot Dog was one of my joys.
You want me to give you the actual title of this program?
Would you please?
Yes, this program is Hot Dog.
Hot Dog was a show that was on Saturday morning in 1970, maybe 71, I can't remember now. It was a program about stuff. Is that really lead in a lead pencil? How do they make hot dogs? What's mustard? You know, things that you see most every day that you never think about, that you take for granted. But they got to come from somewhere. I had four comedy hosts. What makes popcorn pop? You know, and they would give comedy answers, or they would try and explain it. Get this now. My four comedy hosts were Tom Smothers, Joanne Worley, Jonathan Winters, and Woody Allen.
Mm-hmm.
The only show that Woody Allen ever did.
How did you get him involved, Woody Allen?
Knew Woody. I've known Woody all my life, practically. I was a nightclub comic back 1853, I think it was, somewhere in there.
Prior centuries.
Yeah, I think they had comedy clubs back then. And Woody was, we were all in the mix then in those days. And, you know, like that, went to Woody and I said, hey, you want to do that? He said, sure.
Why not?
Yeah,
Are you still in touch?
Woody has gone his way and I've gone mine. Let's put it that way. No is the answer, the simple answer.
You wrote television scripts as well in the 70s.
I did.
What was the magic you needed to have to craft a comedic script in the 70s?
Wow. Well, first of all, you had to have a form. And by that, I mean I wrote, produced, and directed The Odd Couple with Jack Klugman and Tony Randall. You had those two characters to work with. So you just expanded on it or told new stories about those two people.
How would you begin thinking about a script? Would a scenario come into your head? What if they went bowling together?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You're absolutely right. What if they went bowling together? And you go from there. You go from that.
You also did commercials.
Yeah.
Lots of commercials.
Yeah.
Well, how was that different from being in television or film as a character versus being in a commercial as a spokesman?
One thing is you're not writing the copy and you're not creating the characters, if there are characters involved in that. So you come in as a voice actor or as a on-camera actor and kind of do what they tell you to do. If you're appropriate for it, then you just do what you do.
Morning, gals. I've got some news for you. I sold the farm. Looks like you'll be working for someone else. Now, don't you go worrying. He's an old friend. It's Foremost.
You must have been good at selling yourself. Work in so many different regards.
I guess so, yeah. I don't think of myself as a, you know the word starker? Yeah, it's a hard-nosed salesman, a starker, a guy who comes in and says, here, you got to have my salt. You can't have anybody else's salt. But I was never a starker. I had wonderful management, and they found opportunities for me. But it's the same with anything. Other people can open a door for you. But once you get inside that door, you've got to deliver.
Frank Buxton has had a long career, still ongoing in the entertainment and performance industry. Thanks so much for coming in, taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
This is Weekday.
Frank Buxton spoke with KUOW's Katie Sewell. It's 9:32. This November, a Washington ballot measure will ask you whether you want food labels to indicate genetically engineered ingredients. How important or meaningful would that sort of labeling be? We'll hear from both sides of the issue today during the noon hour on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Chamber Music Society, celebrating the 2013 Summer Festival with a roster of 40 artists, concerts and recitals at Benaroya Hall, live broadcasts in local parks, and family programs. June 29th through July 26th. Details at seattlechambermusic.org.
It's going to be hot today, perhaps even record-breakingly hot. The high temp record at SeaTac Airport for July 1st is 87 degrees. That most recently happened in 1995. Today we're expecting to hit 92 with lots of sun, and it's going to be sunny and hot all week. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:34. Student loan rates just doubled. We'll find out why and what it means for college students in 30 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. We've heard a lot about the role the Tea Party's played in recent congressional debates, but we haven't heard a lot of concrete information about who the Tea Party actually is. University of Washington political science professor Chris Parker and his colleague Matt Barreto had some theories about the Tea Party, and they devised some in-depth polling to find out if they were right. The result of the work's been published in a new book. It's called Change: They Can't Believe in the Tea Party and Reality. Reactionary Politics in America. UW political science professor Chris Parker is here in the studios. It's great to be talking with you.
Thank you for the invitation, Marcy.
Initial premise about the Tea Party. Where did you start?
Well, what happened was I was sitting down one day and I was reading the newspaper. The first newspaper I read was the New York Times. And there was a famous or infamous Frank Rich piece, you know, in which he basically indicted the Tea Party as being, you know, somewhere out there in the netherworld, right? Not sort of real people. And then shortly thereafter, I read a piece by Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal, followed by one by Juan Williams. And so the Wall Street Journal pieces obviously clash with the New York Times piece. And I said to my little dog at the time, who was sitting there with me, I said, Daisy, we got data on this. Let's go check this out. And that's where it all began. I just wanted to look at these things empirically because that's what I do as a social scientist. And I just so happened to have a couple questions on a survey I had just put into the field in March of 2010. And I just did some simple analyses, and whatever I did, I could not disentangle how people who support the Tea Party tended to be more racist, homophobic, xenophobic, and sexist than anybody else.
So that's the initial assumption. This is what I think about these people. And then who got these surveys? Who answered your questions?
Well, so we did three surveys. The first survey took place between January 2010 and March 2010. Fortunately, it took place right during the height of the healthcare debate, and that was, as we recall, that was a pretty interesting time in American history, early on in the Obama administration. And so we surveyed seven states, and then after that, we got the results, and we knew that we had to do a much larger survey. So the next time, the same time of year, 2011, we surveyed 13 states and we interviewed 1,500 people. The first survey was 1,000. The next time we increased it by 50%. And we tailored it more towards the Tea Party at that point. And we also conducted some interviews between those two surveys in which we went back to a small select number of people who we originally surveyed and asked them what are called open-ended questions instead of the closed-ended questions that, you know, that are called forced choice. We just said, hey, what do you think about President Obama? And we just let them go. Right.
So how do you, I've always wondered how you find the people that you're selecting. Were you looking for an even number who identified as sympathetic to the Tea Party or just people?
No, this was a stratified survey sample. So what we do is we get them off of what's called a list, right? And we just randomly call them. So we buy lists of maybe 50,000 people in total. Like if for the first survey, it was 50,000. For the second survey, it was 80,000 people, right? And we just randomly call them throughout these states.
And then right. I find the ones who are going to actually follow through and then ask them your questions.
Exactly.
Well, one of the things that you start with right off the bat is you talked about homophobic, sexist, racist. You mentioned 2008, 2009, the healthcare debate had heated up, but the Tea Party really didn't exist as an entity with a name before President Obama was elected, did it?
That's correct. So when we think about when the Tea Party first got going, people associated with the infamous or famous Rinksatelli rage in early 2009, and the president had only been in office. I mean, the seat was still warm after he got into office. And so what happens is what I like to point out to people is that Tea Party is really about fiscal responsibility and smaller government. Where were they on Bush's watch? Right. Bush came in with a $700 billion surplus. He left with a $1.3 trillion deficit, which is a $2 trillion swing. Right. Bush also is the one that initiated TARP. Right. If you look at discretionary spending on Bush's watch, it increased by 104%, but it only increased by comparison by 10% on Clinton's watch. So if the Tea Party is really about fiscal responsibility, small government, where were they on Bush's watch? We didn't see them.
So that would lead you to put fiscal responsibility to the side in identifying what the Tea Party stands for.
Well, I think there are some of them that do really truly believe in fiscal responsibility and small government, but that's not all of them. I would hazard to say that's not even most of them.
We use that name Tea Party, which is very catchy, harkens back to the American Revolution, but it's not a party necessarily in that, well, maybe it is a party in celebratory sense, but it's not like a Republican or Democratic Party that you are a card-carrying member necessarily. Most of the people that you end up talking about in this book are more sympathetic than membership.
Yeah, that's correct. What we did was, because you have several books out there now that talk about and discuss Tea Party members, and what we wanted to do is we wanted to depart from that way of doing things, and we did so for two reasons primarily. One, because we knew there was no work out there in Tea Party sympathizers, but two, when you look at Tea Party members, if you look at Tea Party members in the context of the entire voting age public, that's only 2% of the people, of the population, right? So we wanted to try to grasp something much larger than that. And so what we found is, you know, between 20 and 25% of the voting age public highly identify with the Tea Party. And what that means is, in terms of math, that's about 45 million Americans who identify with the Tea Party.
We're talking with Chris Parker, University of Washington professor, about his book, Change They Can't Believe In. It's an analysis of who the Tea Party is and what the Tea Party, in its largest sense, stands for. And if it's not fiscal responsibility, Chris Parker, what are some of the things that are held in common by sympathizers to the Tea Party?
Well, sympathizers are what my colleague and I call reactionary conservatives. And what that means is, so if you look at a more moderate conservative, is someone who doesn't necessarily embrace change, right? But they understand change is necessary in order to maintain a stable society, right? So they'd rather have incremental organic change than revolutionary change. If we recall, Edmund Burke, you know, the father of modern conservatism, that's one of his critiques of the French Revolution, right? Change happened too fast, right? Mm-hmm. And then we got what we got with the French Revolution. So a reactionary conservatism, a conservative doesn't necessarily, they don't want change at all. As a matter of fact, they're looking backwards in time, right? They want to see a time or relive a time during which their social group was ascendant, right? Unquestioned hegemony. Right. And so they're looking backwards in time. They don't not only want change and arrest change, they want to go backwards. Right. So let's concretize this. So when we think about Obama and the argument that we make in the book, I hope I'm not skipping too far forward.
No, go ahead.
But the argument that we make in the book is that whenever you get these reactionary right wing movements and we compare them to the Klan of the 1920s and the John Birch Society of the late 1950s, early 1960s, and going all the way back to the Know Nothing Party of the 1850s, what do all three of these groups, not including the Tea Party, have in common? Well, change, large scale social change was happening, right? When we look at the Know Nothing Party, it was about the influx of Catholic immigrants, right?
Mm-hmm.
When we look at the Klan of the 1920s, and I want to make sure I'm clear, I'm not talking about the Klan of the 19th century. I'm not talking about the Klan of the 1950s, right? Those are regional reactionary movements, right? And I'll clarify that in a moment, if you will. But the difference is that you know, so the Klan of the 1920s, they feared the return of the quote-unquote new Negro from World War I. They feared that Jews would completely take over capitalism lock, stock, and barrel, and they were concerned about papal influence into American politics through Catholic immigrants, right? And so that's the change that they were scared of. That's a change, if you will, they didn't believe in, right? And we talk about the John Birch Society, they were scared of the civil rights movement, right? So what they did was they took the civil rights movement, right, and the goals of the civil rights movement that it necessitated a larger central government to implement this, right, and they conflated it with communism.
So who is the Tea Party scared of?
The Tea Party is scared of Obama and everything he represents, right? These so-called, these quote-unquote non-real Americans, right? So if we think about phenotypically what a quote-unquote real American is, right? Generally white, male, middle class or better, straight, Protestant.
And when you talk to the members that you survey, the people who identified with the Tea Party, that's how it shook out? They were white, male, Protestant, well off?
Not necessarily well off, but if you look at the income distribution among strong Tea Party supporters, you have more of them that make over $100,000 than anybody else.
Is it because President Obama is not white? Is it because he represents something politically, some political idea that they're scared of, or is it both of those things?
No, it's not a white black thing, right? Because I think Colin Powell would probably have, you know, got some of this blowback, but not what we see with Obama. It's the foreignness that's associated with him, right? That his father was born in Africa, right? And the fact that you can get someone putatively smart, like Dinesh D'Souza, talking about his father tried to inculcate him with these anti-colonialist ideals. It's like, isn't that why this country was founded? On anti-colonialism? I just find it deeply ironic. Maybe it's just me. I don't know. But it's this foreignness that's associated with the president and all of the groups, right, that have risen, you know, with his political rise.
So in terms of looking at the 2012 voting patterns, the fact that Hispanics, Asian Americans, African Americans in massive numbers, massive majorities voted for Barack Obama would prove their point that it's them, they're all voting for Obama and we are voting for somebody else.
Exactly. So these people who are Tea Party sympathizers, much like the Klan of the 1920s, once again, and much like the John Birch Society, they feel and felt that their country is being stolen from them, right? The America that they beloved is being stolen from them. It is no longer their country.
So did you actually have respondents to your surveys or the open-ended questions say that to you?
They didn't say they were stolen. They not stolen like that, but they would say the America I know is no more. They would say stuff like that. But I want to bring out another sort of empirical difference between reactionary conservatives and moderate conservatives or Tea Party conservatives and non-Tea Party conservatives. So we ask a question on this survey. do you think Barack Obama is trying to destroy the country, right? And we ask him that question because that's of a piece of Richard Hofstadter's work in The Paranoid Style in American Politics, in which he says that to these people, you know, this isn't just about politics. This is about life and death, right? And so they have to demonize the opposition, their political opposition, as the enemy, right? And in this case, it's Barack Obama. So this is what we found, Marcy. So if you looked at all self-identified conservatives, 36% believe that Barack Obama is trying to destroy the country. But if you disaggregate it and you look at it with Tea Party conservatives and non-Tea Party conservatives, the results are arresting. So for non-Tea Party conservatives, only 6% believe that to be true. For Tea Party conservatives, 71% believe that to be true.
Chris Parker is a professor of political science at the University of Washington. His new book's called Change They Can't Believe In, and it's full of data about the Tea Party. So he's not just spouting these theories. He's got numbers to back them up, which led me to think about the, I'm not sure of the exact percentage of self-identified Tea Party sympathizers who are in Congress or not, but it seems that their political influence in Washington, D.C. might be disproportionate to the numbers that are there. And I bet you have that number in your book. He's looking it up right now. I'm just wondering, because you are talking about a small percentage who have deeply held beliefs. Many were elected to Congress, but they are not the majority of the Republican Party.
Yeah. So there are about 52 people that are in the House that are part of the Tea Party caucus, right?
And out of more than 300.
Yes. But here's the thing. The people that support the Tea Party, identify with the Tea Party, they're much more likely to be politically engaged than non-Tea Party conservatives. And let's just give you an example, okay? When we look at the numbers in the 2010 election, we asked whether or not you voted in the 2010 election. So 96% of Tea Party conservatives did versus only 74% of non-Tea Party conservatives. So if you look on that, no, that was voting Republican. If we're just talking about voting in the election in 2010, it's 92-78. If we look at attended a political meeting in the last 12 months, 40% of Tea Party conservatives did that, and only 18% of non-Tea Party conservatives did that. And whether or not you're interested in politics, right, 85% of Tea Party conservatives were interested in politics at the time versus only 66% of non-Tea Party conservatives.
So what you're describing is a highly motivated block of people.
They're very engaged.
And so they're engaged, which leads me to wonder then what has happened to the more traditional conservatives, which used to be the Republican Party base. Are they so moved to the background? Have they disengaged, or are they just content to let this more vocal, more animated group lead the way?
I think it's more the case that the Tea Party conservatives are just more animated now, which is not to say that the more mainstream or moderate conservatives aren't a little disappointed with the candidates that they have. I mean, look at the candidates that ran and, you know, for the Senate, right, in 2010 and 2012. I mean, they were jokes. I mean, what, Sharon Angle, Christine O'Donnell, you know, lately Aiken, you know, I mean, these people just had no chance.
Well, what does that say in general? I mean, you're studying the Tea Party, but then I wonder, because what we see also, you're talking about candidates, but there are many people who describe themselves as fiscal conservatives who are leaving the U.S. Senate, leaving Congress, maybe even leaving governorships. Because of maybe an unspoken, sometimes a spoken frustration with what has happened to the conservative movement?
Well, yeah, I mean, I find that to be less the case at the gubernatorial level because, they're executives. In Congress as a whole, I mean, you know, some of these people are, you know, I mean, think about what happened a couple weeks ago in which Bob Dole said neither he nor Ronald Reagan could make it in a Republican Party today. It's because the Republican Party has drifted so far away from what they once were. Republicans used to make deals. You know, they used to sacrifice, right? They used to make deals with Democrats for the good of the country. More and more now, though, they're not willing to do so, right? And this, once again, goes back to what Richard Hofstadter said in his book, The Paranoid Style, in that, you know, these quote-unquote pseudo-conservatives, right now he's talking about the Goldwater Republicans back in the day, that these pseudo-conservatives see compromise as a dirty word. They see it as surrender, right? Well, we see the same thing happening right now, right?
So you, when we started off describing what a reactionary is, it's somebody who wants to return, there's a fear, but it almost sounds as if it's revolutionary in addition to being reactionary, because it as opposed to compromise, which is what a lot of people have seen as sort of the status quo of American politics, we're talking about people who are drawing a line in the sand and saying, this is what has to happen. For maybe maybe it's not for change or change in their mind, but it seems almost revolutionary. It seems much more proactive than reactive in a sense.
Well, it's the reason why we say it's reactive is because it is reacting to this change.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, which is not to say that the outcome could not be revolutionary. I doubt it, but one could interpret it that way. Here's something else I wanted to point out, however, another difference between moderate conservatives, reactionary conservatives, and that is a conservative really believes in good order and discipline, law and order, right? Well, when we think about the Tea Party and we think about their behavior when it came to the debt ceiling debates, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that could have really, really put the United States, you know, in a financial hardship, right? And really could have upended financial stability, right? Well, that's not what a conservative wants. A real conservative does not want financial instability, right? But these people did.
Right, which is why I say it doesn't seem so much conservative. They're reacting to something. So it seems like an active defiance to status quo or
yeah.
The way business is done.
Yeah, yeah. But once again, it's the reason why we name it reactionary,
okay.
Because it's reacting to some stimulus.
Chris Parker is with us. He's professor of political science at the University of Washington. As you mentioned, you have compared the Tea Party to the 1920s Ku Klux Klan and National Movement and to the John Birch Society of the late 50s, early 1960s. And to the know-nothings of the 19th century. So is one of the conclusions then that there's always this strain in American politics, that we always have a certain percentage who have extreme right-wing views as we also have a certain percentage with extreme left-wing views?
That is correct. We believe that to be entirely the case, right? But it takes something in the current political environment to trigger it, right? These people, these feelings and these sentiments are always there. Right. But we think that it takes something in the current political environment to trigger it. So let me give you an example. So my colleague at Harvard, Theda Skocpol's book, in which she writes on Tea Party members.
Mm.
Right. And she says that there are some people that were John Birch Society folks back in the 60s who are now Tea Partiers now. Right. And so these sentiments are always there. And what we hypothesize is that these sentiments are inculcated and socialized during childhood and they never leave you.
So essentially, the election of Barack Obama was a trigger of sorts. This has tipped the balance for us.
When you think about who the president is, think about what the president represents for us as Americans, right? The president is not only the face of the country, but the president is also the head of government, right? The president is chief law enforcement officer. The president is commander in chief. And for many of us, from the time we're little kids, we identify with the president, right? It's a symbol of the country. So for some people, when they see a non-black man that's heading the country, regardless of what his policies are, right? Because his policies have pretty much been centrist. And if we start talking about foreign policy, he's on the right.
Right.
Right. So regardless of what his policies are or have been, right. It's like they see a non-black man as president. That's not what they're accustomed to seeing. That's not the America that they know. And that symbolizes the change they can't believe in.
Well, if we look at the pendulum of American politics throughout the existence of this country, we're just about at the 4th of July. So it's time to think about American history. Are there always the swings? There's triggers throughout the years. Rise of more right-wing movements and then maybe rise of more left-wing movements. Is this just, if you look at this historically, this is just a time or is this permanent? Is this anger permanent until you know, another white man is elected president? Or if Hillary Clinton got elected in 2016, would the anger continue? Because it's still not the way they want it to be.
Well, I think as soon as Barack Obama exit stage left, and no pun intended. I think that the Tea Party anger, and it is anger for sure, will abate. Now, if Hillary decides to run, I don't think they'll call themselves a Tea Party anymore. They'll be the same people, but they'll have a different name. I really don't think it'll be the Tea Party anymore.
But they aren't going to like her any
they're
better.
They're not going to like, well, I think they'll be less fearful of her, right? And I think a lot of her, a lot of what sort of steers a hostility towards her is politics. It's not about who she is necessarily.
So they don't like where she stands. I'm going to ask you to move back to the mic a little bit. So now you've got this data. You have confirmed the thesis that you started out with. Where do you go? What do you build with now that you've got this?
So the next step is to look at this internationally, right? Because, I mean, you think about what's happening in Europe, you know, with the Swedish Democrats. You think about the National Front in France. You think about the English Defense League. I mean, you can look all over Europe and you see similar movements happening. Now, it's not necessarily over race per se. It's about immigration. You know, it's about, you know, people being scared of Muslims, right? It's about all these other issues that are associated with Europe that we don't necessarily have here, but conceptually they're still the same. It's about these others trying to come into their country, or the perception that these others are stealing their country from them.
It's fascinating. Chris Parker is the Sheingold Professor of Social Justice and Political Science at the University of Washington. And with Associate Professor Matt Barreto, he's the author of Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for the invitation, Marcy.
A little something to think about as we approach the 4th of July. This is KUOW.
And now, the sound of the day.
Cicadas. It might be heating up here in the Northwest, but that is one summer sound that we don't have. Listener Marjorie was recently in Hudson, New York at Olana, the estate of Frederick Church from the Hudson River School of Painters. Marjorie says the grounds are beautiful, but super hot. Sort of like here, and the air was filled with the sound of cicadas, especially when she stood in the shade of a big tree where they clearly must have been congregating. Maybe we'll hear cicadas here because it's going to be darn hot today. What interesting sounds are you listening to? Record 30 seconds and send the sound to us along with the story behind it. You can email your audio file to weekday@kuow.org. Include sound of the day in the subject line. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to talk about student loans doubling today officially, unless Congress takes action before they recess in August. Kids who go to college who have federal loans are going to have to be paying a lot more money, Bernard.
That's right. They're jumping from 3.4% up to 6.8%. We'll have more on that in just a couple minutes. It's 9:59. In other news today, European officials are upset about claims that the U.S. spies on its European allies. Secretary of State John Kerry is playing down those spying claims, saying those sorts of security efforts are not unusual. An update on all this in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
David Faga is a former public defender who says some people on sex offender registries shouldn't have to bear that label, but few will speak for them.
If you stand up as a politician, you're going to be vilified as coddling sex offenders and you're toast.
Coming up on the story, the making of a film about Miracle Village, a remote place in Florida where sex offenders live.
That's this afternoon at 2 on KUOW's second program service, KUOW2. If you hadn't heard it yet, see what it sounds like. It's online at KUOW. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.